Schweizer Amerika.
News from the Sister Republic. A University of St. Gallen podcast by Claudia Brühwiler.
Grüezi miteinander and welcome back to another episode of Views from the Sister Republic. Today, we are revisiting the topic of the last conversation, which I recorded with Professor James Davis, the war on Iran. In late February, Israeli airstrikes, soon joined by the United States, targeted key sites across Iran, triggering a chain reaction. Iran retaliated with missile and drone attacks across the region and, in a move with massive global implications, closed the Strait of Hormuz. That sent shockwaves through energy markets and international trade. At the same time, the internal balance of power in Tehran appears to be shifting, with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps stepping into an apparently more dominant role. On Tuesday this week, on April 9th, President Trump escalated the current situation with warnings against Iran, threatening that, should they not negotiate and reopen the Strait of Hormuz, a whole civilization will die tonight. That was his Truth Social post. We are today recording on the Thursday of the same week, and the US has obviously not targeted any civilian infrastructure so far, let alone wiped out Iran's civilization. Instead, we are on day two of the ceasefire, although Israel continues its strikes in Lebanon. Is this the beginning of the war's end? And what could a negotiated settlement achieve at this point? And how stable is Iran's regime? To help us make sense of this rapidly evolving situation, I'm joined today by Dr. Ras Zimt, one of the leading experts on Iran. Welcome to the podcast, Ras.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Ras, you are the director of the Iran and Shiite Axis Research Program at the Institute for National Security Studies, an independent think tank affiliated with the University of Tel Aviv, and you are a longtime analyst of Iranian politics, society, and strategies. Our listeners are likely to have come across your name very recently because you have been interviewed by numerous news outlets, including German-speaking media such as Neue Zürcher Zeitung, Spiegel, Frankfurter Rundschau, and Tagesspiegel. And I'd actually like to come back to one of the interviews that you gave. On March 8th, so really a month ago, you gave an interview to NZZ am Sonntag, a Swiss Sunday newspaper, in which you expressed surprise at Iran's attacks on the Gulf states. And you ended the interview suggesting that there would be, I quote, more surprises in the coming weeks. What have been to you the biggest surprises, the most surprising turns of the conflict in the last month?
Yeah, so if I remember correctly, what I said that interview was not that I was surprised with the fact that Iran targeted the Gulf states, because even before the war, Ayatollah Khamenei, the late supreme leader of Iran, said very clearly that in case of a war with the United States and Israel, Iran will turn this war into a regional war. But I personally thought that Iran might start by attacking Israel and then perhaps also the U.S. forces in the region. And only in a later stage of this war will escalate things even further by attacking the Gulf states as well. So that was a kind of surprise. I think about shortly afterwards, what we saw was another stage of escalation, which again could have been anticipated because Iran put that option on the table. And I of course mean the Iranian decision to close or to use its control over the Hormuz Strait. But I did not believe that it would come at such an early stage. And I think that, I was not surprised with the resilience of the Islamic Republic, because I think it's very very clear to all Iran watchers. We are all very much aware of the resilience of the Islamic Republic after 47 years since the Islamic Revolution. But I have to say that what surprised me a little bit was that if at the beginning of the war, my sense was that the main objective of the Islamic Republic was just to survive this war, which was not very easy because they certainly had to face two giant military powers, both Israel and the United States. But very quickly, I think Iran reached the conclusion that it's not just about surviving the war. They might actually use this war as an opportunity to achieve different goals. First of all, to get some kind of security guarantees that if and when there is going to be a ceasefire, it's going to be a permanent ceasefire, unlike what happened after the 12-day war in June. And the second thing would be to make sure that Iran gets economic benefits and can use its control on the Hormuz Straits and the appreciation in the region that Iran can certainly cause a lot of damage to global economy, to the United States, to its neighboring states, in a way which would allow Iran to form some kind of regional architectures which would acknowledge Iran's position in the region.
Have the United States and Israel not been prepared for this scenario? Because it's for outside observers who are not as deeply in the subject as you are, quite puzzling how it could be allowed that that Iran uses its position with the Hormuz Strait for leverage in this manner.
You know, as someone who spent more than two decades in the Israeli military intelligence, I can tell you that almost in all simulations in which I took part for many years, the closure of the Hormuz Strait was one of the options. Now, I have to say that from the Israeli perspective, this was not a major issue. I mean, with all due respect to Hormuz Strait, Israel doesn't really care about the oil traffic through Hormuz. Israel, when it comes to the Israeli perspective towards Iran, the nuclear issue has always been the number one priority. Then Iran's ballistic missiles capabilities, Iran's involvement in terrorism, Iran's regional aspirations. Iran's navy was never has never been considered as by the Israelis as a major challenge. I think that the U.S., which certainly had to put much more attention to this option due to its implications on global economy, was probably aware of the possibility. But, you know, sometimes there is a difference between understanding that this is an option and really grasping the potential it has. And perhaps the understanding in the United States was that even if that happens, and if the Iranians try to block the Hormuz Strait, it's not going to be as difficult to deal with that. And that was, I think, a surprise for the United States, both concerning the timing. I think that in the United States as well, as I said before, there was this assessment that if Iran really uses this leverage, it will be only in the later stages of the war, and that might allow the U.S. to prepare better for this option, or that if this option materialized, then it might be less difficult for the United States at this point to deal with the closure of the Straits.
What would dealing with the closure of the Strait actually mean? It has been suggested that it's not really possible to deal with it unless one commits ground troops.
I tend to agree because, first of all, we have to remember that the main threat is not just Iran's decision to use its navy. For example, through putting mines in the strait. The main challenge is Iran's ability to use its missiles and drones to target vessels in Hormuz. So even if there is a ground operation, which, for example, takes control of the strait itself, it will still allow Iran to launch missiles or drones at vessels going through the strait. Now, another option was to take control of the Kharg Island, which has nothing directly to do with Hormuz, but as kind of a leverage. The assumption was that if the United States uses boots on the ground in order to take control of Kharg Island, which is used by the Iranians to export more than 85% of its oil abroad, this would put a major pressure on the Iranians to open up the strait. My sense was that even if that happens, it will take at least a few weeks or even months until Iran begins to pay the price and forced into making concessions. And so, in addition to the possible costs on the U.S. forces themselves, because we all aware of the fact that such a ground operation might be very risky from the U.S. point of view, and until Iran is convinced to open the straits, it might certainly inflict major damage not just on the traffic itself, but also continuing its launching of missiles and drones at its neighbors, and that by itself is something which will be very difficult for them to sustain.
There seems to be a lack of resolve, pretty much on the side of the US. At least that is how many in Europe are commenting, and also in the US are commenting on how quickly Donald Trump pressured Iran for a ceasefire. On Wednesday, he posted that it was, quote, a big day for world peace. Iran wants it to happen. They've had enough. Likewise, so has everyone else. But many just saw this as a sign of weakness from the US. What is the perspective in Israel on this? How is the ceasefire evaluated and Trump's pressure to have a ceasefire relatively quickly?
You know, unfortunately, I have to say, the reaction in Israel to almost everything to date depends on the attitude of the Israelis towards Prime Minister Netanyahu. If you are pro-Netanyahu, you will accept everything which the Israeli government says. And so when Prime Minister Netanyahu describes the current situation with Iran as a great success for Israel, because we managed to degrade very significantly Iranian missiles capabilities, its industries, its air force, its navy, those who support Prime Minister Netanyahu tend to agree with that and accept that narrative. Those, on the other hand, who do not support, Prime Minister Netanyahu, even if this was a major success from the Israeli point of view, they will say, no, this is another failure by Prime Minister Netanyahu. I think that the situation is very complex. My personal view is that, first of all, we still have to wait and see what will happen during the negotiations. I think that from the Israeli point of view, there were three main objectives. One was not to topple the Iranian regime. That was not the declared objective of Israel. The declared objective, as Prime Minister Netanyahu described, was to create the conditions which perhaps could enable a regime change in Iran when the war is over. So if and when the hundreds of thousands of or millions of Iranians are going to go back to the streets after the war is over, it might be more or less difficult for the Iranian regime due to the decapitation of Iranian leadership, due to the fact that Israel managed to target IRGC, meaning Revolutionary Guards, besiege law enforcement forces, headquarters and bases. It might be more difficult for them to crash and a potential uprising. I think that when it comes to this objective, and we can elaborate on that later on, we are in a very problematic situation. The bottom line is that we have no indication whatsoever that the Islamic Republic is on the verge of regime change at this point. The second objective from the Israeli point of view was to degrade even further Iran's ballistic missiles capabilities. Here I'm a little bit more optimistic than I was after the 12-day war, because during the 12-day war in June, Israel managed to target especially the missiles and the launchers, but it was unable to strike, or it didn't want to strike, the production lines. This time, Israel and the United States also targeted the production lines, the military security industries in Iran. And that certainly was certainly impossible to destroy Iran's missiles capabilities. But I think that it will be much more difficult for Iran to reconstitute its ballistic missiles capabilities after the war is over. That doesn't mean that they will not be able to do that. But in my view, it will take much longer than what we saw after the 12-day war in June. Last but not least, and I think this is the main objective from the Israeli point of view, was to make sure that Iran is forced into accepting some demands concerning their nuclear program.
Now,
one was to take care of the fissile material, meaning the 440 kilograms of enriched uranium to 60%, which still remains in Iran since the 12-day war in June. This was a demand made by the United States during the negotiations between Mr. Witkoff and Mr. Arakchi before the war, and the Iranians were not ready to accept that. The another thing was for the Iranians to suspend the enrichment of uranium for as much as possible, probably around 10 years or so, and also to take care of the uranium enriched to 20%, which also is left in Iran. And here I think we will have to see what's going to happen in Islamabad, in Pakistan. If the war ends with some kind of compromise, which will take care of those remained nuclear capabilities, this will be considered by Israel as a major success. Again, other things are less promising at this point.
I would like to return to the question of regime change later on, because this is really a big concern that has been guiding the entire observation of this conflict from the get-go. You've mentioned the two objectives that have also been stated by the Trump administration as being the main objectives, really, the prevention from Iran moving beyond its status as a nuclear threshold state, actually moving it away from that threshold and decimating its military capabilities, also decimating its navy. It has also stated, at least Donald Trump did so in a speech, that they wanted to weaken the militias in the region that have been depending on Iranian support. That is another arena where we haven't really seen, or it is hard to grasp whether we have seen any improvement. What is your take on that point?
Look, my understanding has always been, especially since the October war in Gaza began, that Iran's support for its non-state actors in the region, the so-called axis of resistance, is certainly one of the things that Israel has to deal with. But the best way to deal with that is through a direct confrontation with each of the different members of this axis. So if, for example, and from the Israeli perspective, Hezbollah is the number one priority, of course, Israel has to take care of this threat, regardless of what we do or don't do concerning Iran. Of course, if the Iranian regime at some point collapses, this will be the major thing which would probably prevent Hezbollah from being able to continue as a major security threat to the Israeli national security. But I think that even if there is no change from the Iranian point of view, and Iran might still continue to support Hezbollah, we have to deal with that, for example, through some kind of economic financial warfare against channels of deliveries of money from Tehran to Hezbollah. But the main thing is to try and make sure that we move forward, either unilaterally Israeli or with the support of the Lebanese government and the Lebanese army to disarm Hezbollah, especially southern to the Litani River, which of course is considered by Israel as a major security threat. The same goes with Iraq. I think that if the international community, because this is not just an Israeli problem, if the international community and the United States wants to deal with the very problematic situation in Iraq, in which the pro-Iranian militias actually have become a deep state or a state from within the state inside Iraq, and control a major part of Iraqi both political and economic systems, the best way to do that is not just to deal with the Iranian influence in Baghdad, but also to deal either militarily or in other means with the continued and increased influence of the pro-Iranian militias in Iraq. And so I think that unlike the nuclear issue and the ballistic missiles issues or other military capabilities in Iran, which has to be directly dealt with Iran, Iran's support for its proxies requires a different kind of approach.
So we're now moving into this negotiation stage during the ceasefire. What do you think can realistically be achieved right now?
Look, first of all, I have to say that my sense is that both sides, both the Americans and the Iranians, really want this negotiation to succeed. And to they certainly don't want to go back to war. It doesn't necessarily mean that it will succeed. And there are already some obstacles. For example, the Israeli operations in Lebanon and the threats made by Iran to violate the ceasefire if Israel continues to attack in Lebanon. But I think that if negotiations continue, then the main issue from the Iranian point of view would be to make sure that that they get, at the end of the day, some economic benefits, either through reparations for the war, either through their control over the Strait of Hormuz, either through sanctions relief, if the Americans are ready to give them that, and also some kind of guarantee that the U.S. and Israel are not going to attack Iran in the near future. From the U.S. point of view, I think that it's very clear, unfortunately, that the demands concerning the ballistic missiles and the proxies are not going to be on the table. Even if they are raised by the Americans, I really don't think that the Americans will not be able to reach some kind of understanding with the Iranians because of those issues. And so I think that with the, in addition to the issue of Hormuz Strait, which, as I said before, unfortunately has become a major issue during the war, the only issue which I think that the Americans will insist on is the nuclear issue. And here again, the question is whether the Iranians will agree to give more concessions compared to what they were ready to give during the negotiations before the war. Hopefully, yes.
But has the U.S. and Israel, in conjunction with the U.S., moved enough in the direction to threaten Iran's nuclear capability is that it would make such concessions? Because, for instance, Pickaxe Mountain, as it is called, I think, has not been touched.
Yes, you are right. But I think that the major issue is not what we managed to do or didn't manage to do concerning the nuclear program, is the military threat to strike Iran's infrastructures and its energy sector. I mean, at the end of the day, we have to admit that despite whether we like the tone of President Trump's tweets and statements, I personally don't like them, but this is another story. But at the end of the day, it really it had an impact on the Iranian position. Yesterday, there was this report that only 2 days or 3 days before the expiration of the ultimatum, the Iranian position was that they were not ready to agree to any kind of negotiations unless they get some kind of guarantee that it's going to be a permanent ceasefire. And only in the last 24 hours before the ultimatum was expired, the leader of Iran, Mujtaba Khamenei, made a decision to adopt, I would say, something which could be referred to as a tactical concession. And he gave his permission to be engaged in negotiations, despite the fact that it was only temporary ceasefire. So there was an impact. And so I think that if Iran really wants to avoid the resumption of the war, and I think that this is a very clear Iranian interest, they might be ready to give some concessions. Again, I don't think, for example, that Iran is going to agree to give up their rights to enrich uranium inside Iran. But I think that even before the war, one of the ideas, for example, was that the U.S. might recognize, in principle, Iran's right to enrich uranium, but we'll say, okay, you have this right, but the implementation of this right will happen only after, let's say, 10 years. During the in the next 10 years, you are not allowed to enrich uranium. You still have this right, but you are not going to implement that. This is one of the solutions which could pave the way for some kind of agreement between the two states. Again, the main issue is what will happen with the 440 kilograms of 60% enriched uranium.
Earlier, you listed the objectives of the war as they had been claimed by Benjamin Netanyahu, with the first being conditions that would allow for the people of Iran to work towards a regime change. And you already suggested that you've become pessimistic about that being achieved. You already in earlier interviews said that this regime is not a house of cards that will simply fall apart once we pull at it, but that it was a bulwark. And looking at what you've listed as possible outcomes of negotiation, this sounds very much like this regime could actually survive.
Yes. Look, I was never optimistic concerning the possibility for regime change in Iran through aerial strikes. During the protest movement, or the last wave of protest in Iran in December, January 2026, until, of course, this brutal suppression of the protest in January 8th or 9th, I certainly thought that certain conditions were met, which might pave the way for the collapse of the Islamic Republic. But I never thought that a military strike by itself is able of toppling the Iranian regime. During the Women, Life, Freedom protest movement in Iran in 2022-23, I thought, and I wrote about it, that there were at least three basic conditions which might allow any kind of protest movement in Iran to evolve into some kind of a more significant threat or challenge to the stability of the regime. One would be boots on the ground, and I didn't mean U.S. boots on the ground, I meant Iranian boots on the ground, meaning we have to see millions of Iranians in the streets. At the end of the day, we're speaking about a country of more than 90 million people. So if it's just 200,000 or 500,000 people in the streets, this is not enough to create a change. The second condition would be to see some kind of organized coalition. It doesn't necessarily have to be led by someone, but at least some kind of organized coalition between different parts and sections of the Iranian society working together. And the third and perhaps most important condition would be to see some cracks, divisions, and defections from within the state, from within the security forces inside Iran. And unfortunately, we haven't seen that. I mean, yes, there were some reports in the early stages of the war about several hundreds of members of the Basij or the police who are unwilling to to come to work because of their concern that they might be killed by the Israelis or the Americans. But at the end of the day, what we see, what we still see in Iran, is that the Islamic Republic has managed, at least for now, to preserve its internal cohesiveness, even during the strikes by the Israeli drones against headquarters, bases, checkpoints of the Basij and the Iranian police. What we saw that very quickly they adapted their tactics. They moved from headquarters to schools or civilian institutions. We still see arrests carried out by the regime. We still see executions carried out by the regime. And so it doesn't mean, of course, that at some point, 2 months after the war, 6 months after the war, we might not see the resumption of the protest in Iran, because we have to agree to understand that the basic problems in Iran are still the same, even more significant than they used to be, because the if you take the economic crisis in Iran after the war, of course, it's even deeper than it used to be. So at some point, the Iranians might go to the streets. But unfortunately, I can't say that if and when that happens, I'm not sure if the outcome of the clash between the protesters and the regime is going to be much different from what we saw 3 months ago.
But are we seeing a change in the nature of the regime, a shift in power between supreme leader and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, or is it too early to call that?
So before the war, I said that there were two main scenarios. One, the more optimistic one would be to see a regime change in Iran, but the more likely scenario would be to see a change from within the regime. And that's exactly what happened after Ayatollah Khamenei was killed in the first few hours of the war. The Revolutionary Guards, which have already become much more significant and much more powerful in the last few decades in Iran, because of the policy of Khamenei, who strengthened the Revolutionary Guards in return for their support. The Revolutionary Guards, after the killing of Khamenei, has taken a place in the driver's seat in Iran. Now, I think so in a way, this process of the Islamic Republic of Iran turning or evolving into some kind of authoritarian regime led by the Revolutionary Guards is something which we already see today. I think it's too early to assess what will be the internal dynamics and what will be the relations between the different power centers inside Iran. If you take, for example, the supreme leader of Iran, Mujtaba, the son of Khamenei, some would argue that actually the Revolutionary Guards, in trying to convince and put more pressure on the Assembly of Experts to nominate Mujtaba as the new supreme leader of Iran, had in mind that they will be able to control Mujtaba and turn Mujtaba into some kind of symbolic leader, who is going to be controlled by the Revolutionary Guard. This is one option. I can't rule that out. But on the other hand, we might see Mujtaba, perhaps not now, because he's still in a kind of survival mode. Perhaps after the war is over, and if his physical condition allows him to do that, we might see him trying to strengthen his control, and then we might see some kind of perhaps constitutional changes in Iran, redefinition of the power relations between the Revolutionary Guards, the Speaker of the Majlis, Ghalibaf, the President, the Foreign Ministry. It's probably going to take some time until we see what are the new characteristics of this change from within the regime.
We've now focused mainly on the players: Iran, Israel, the US, but there is a wider neighborhood to consider. How do you think will the war, the negotiations, change the relations between Iran, China, and Russia? these two have been meddling in the region as well.
Yes. Well, on the one hand, I think it the war certainly strengthened in a way the perspective in Iran, which says, okay, perhaps the only two states we can count on, or we can depend on, are China and Russia. Although we have to say that Iranian attempts to reach out to Russia and even China, anyway, after the 12-day war in June, were not very successful. I mean, Russia didn't supply Iran with the advanced aerial defense system Iran wanted Russia to supply. Russia was saying we still need them in the war against Ukraine. China, again, according to what we know, did not supply Iran with advanced weapons, although it did send some components which were very important for the production of ballistic missiles, dual-use components, I would say. Now, during the war, there were some reports about intelligence sharing between Russia and Iran and between China and Iran. But I think that the perception of the current leadership in Iran, led again by the Revolutionary Guards, is that they have nobody else to work with other than China and Russia, because even the relations with the Gulf states, which seem to have improved during the last few years, the resumption of relations with Saudi Arabia in 2023, and then and of course the continued friendly relations with the UAE. The war has actually changed that in a way, and so I think that it will strengthen Iran's willingness to continue what they refer to as the look east strategy. But I think that also in Iran, many realize that there is a limit to what they can expect from both Russia and China. Yes, they can still export more than 90% of their oil to China. They still can have technological military cooperation with Russia. But there is a limit to what the Chinese and even the Russians are ready to give Iran.
To conclude, I would like to move to yet another player who has pretended that all of this does not concern us. And us is Europe, even though the base in Cyprus was struck, even though the UK was, in a sense, a target of Iranian funded terrorism in the past, or attempts of terrorism attacks. And yet the continent is kind of trying to be aloof and out of this. Has the European reaction, if you're lumping it together like this, surprised you? How has this been received again by Israel?
Look, I'll be very, very honest with you. I think that most Israelis don't really think that Europe has any role to play when it comes to the Middle East and Iran. I have to say that as someone who is working in a think tank, our impression in the last few years was that there is a growing understanding in Europe towards the dangers, the challenges, the threats imposed by Iran. I think that a major change happened after the Iranian deliveries of drones to Russia in the war against Ukraine, but also the growing attempts by the Iranians to carry out terrorist attacks, information campaigns in different parts of Europe. But at the end of the day, even after it's very clear today that if you take the ballistic missiles, and we all remember the failed attempt by the Iranians to launch this missile towards the U.S. base, a long range missile. It's very clear that from the tactical point of view, as Israel and the United States have said even before the war, Iran has the capability to reach some parts of Europe as well. But I can certainly understand the priorities in Europe. And I don't think that we can convince the ordinary Europeans to consider Iran the same way Israel has been considered Iran as an existential threat. I would perhaps expect Europe to be more committed to the war with Iran, especially after what happened with the launching of missiles towards the neighbors in the Gulf, and of course the impact of the closure of Hormuz Straits on global economy. On the other hand, I understand this thinking, saying, "Okay, we were dragged in a way to a war imposed by the Israelis and the Americans, and therefore we do not have to pay the price for that, other than what we already have to pay." But from the Israeli point of view, I don't think that there were any real expectations that Europe is going to be more involved.
Thank you, Ross, so much for this insightful conversation. To conclude, what would you recommend our listeners to read, watch, or listen to better understand what is going on right now?
I'll tell you what I tell to my students. You know, sometimes, especially those who are more dealing with Iran mostly from the geopolitical, strategic angles, sometimes have this tendency to present Iran as a state which is mostly about the nuclear program or its ballistic missile or in regional ambitions. And therefore, I always say, start by watching Iranian cinema. Because that's, I think, is even more important to understand Iran, not just as the Islamic Republic of Iran with its strategic capabilities and ambitions, but to understand Iran as a state and as a society. And to understand that Iran is much more than the Islamic Republic and much more than the regime. There are 90 million people living there. And I think that one of the main things is to understand their culture, their variety of Iranians. Whenever I'm asked in Israel, what do the Iranians think about something? I always say, which Iranian? There are 90 million Iranians. So I think we have to realize the complexity of the Iranian. And I think that especially after what Mr. Trump said about the civilization in Iran, with all due respect, the Iranian civilization is an ancient civilization of thousands of years. It cannot be ruined by military strikes. And I think it's important to understand the culture and the cultural, the social elements of Iran as well.
What is your favorite Iranian film?
Wow. I have to think about it. It's a difficult question. There are so many. Yeah.
Too many to choose from.
Too many. Yeah, too many. Unfortunately, the main problem is that most of the producers had to leave Iran.
Yeah.
That's very unfortunate.
But you ended with a beautiful sentiment that Iranian civilization is ancient and cannot be destroyed by military strikes, and I think should not be destroyed.
I totally agree.
So thank you so much for your valuable time, Ras, and thank you to our listeners. With that, I wish you auf Wiedersehen.
Grüezi Amerika. Views from the Sister Republic. A University of St. Gallen podcast by Claudia Brühwiler.